Thank you, Rat Negotia. Actually, I was going to mention the shrine, and I was sitting in meditation just thinking about it a little bit, and particularly appreciate those who have put it together. And as Rat Negotia said, it's got the Bodhisattva of Wisdom, as he's known often. But I just wanted to say that although he's known as the Bodhisattva of Wisdom, whenever we hear or use the word wisdom in the Dharma, we should always remember it means wisdom and compassion. So wisdom and compassion are inseparable from each other. So similarly, the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara, often known as the Bodhisattva of Compassion, also, of course, is very much the Bodhisattva of Wisdom. Yeah. So I want you to just also bear that in mind throughout the talk, whenever I use the word wisdom, or the wise mind or something like that, I'm also referring to the compassionate mind. It's very, very important in Dharma life, and Dharma practice. When Rat Negotia asked me to do this talk, I fairly quickly said yes. I think Bhante once said, if you ever ask to give a talk, just say yes. So whether for that reason or other, I don't know, I just said anyway. But when I started to think about it more deeply, I realised what a big topic it is. And I thought that even giving a talk on each of the three main words, transforming, ignorance and wisdom, would be a whole hour talk on each of those. So what you're going to get is very much, you know, what I can say about the whole thing. It's filtered through my experience and my way of seeing things, I suppose. So just bear that in mind as well. Yeah. So the phrase transforming ignorance into wisdom is the first part of the phrase, the positive expression of the 10th precept, transforming ignorance into wisdom, I purify my mind. The negative counterpart, which comes from the Pali, well, we recite it in Pali, the ancient language, is Micca ditya veramani sikapadam samadhiyami, which means samadhiyami is I undertake, sikapadam the training step or training principle, veramani of abstaining from Micca ditya, Micca ditties or wrong views. Yeah. This talk is about transforming wrong views in particular into right views, and thereby transforming right views into going beyond views altogether into wisdom and compassion. The word ignorance would be translated back into Sanskrit as avidya, and that itself is a very, very broad concept. So I'm only looking really at wrong views, micca ditties, in the first part of the talk anyway. Yeah. In the second part of the talk, I'm going to talk more about wisdom from two particular angles, and hopefully transformation or transforming will be weaved into it as we go along. Yeah. Okay, so talking about wrong views to begin with, one of the favourite bumper stickers on a car that I once saw actually here in Cambridge was, a few years back, don't believe everything you think. And I've always remembered that because I think it's very good advice. Yeah. In fact, I think it probably one could go even further and say question everything you think. Yeah. It's very possible, if not likely, that there are wrong views in what you think. I'll just give you three little examples. These are fairly light-hearted and not particularly kind of ethical issues. But when I lived in Mexico, I used to have lunch with a Mitra friend, and he was a keen swimmer. And he used to go swimming quite a lot. And one time he told me that, in all seriousness, and he really believed this, that one floats better at the deep end of a swimming pool than at the shallow end because there's more water underneath you to hold you up. So he very much firmly believed this. Yeah. Another little thing I remember is one of the guys I work with or closely to our team, he's not in our Buddhist team, but is from Eastern Europe originally, and he said that back in the 50s, I suppose it was, when television was introduced to his communist country, as it was then, his grandmother used to cover the TV set with a cloth or a blanket or something at night because she thought that the Communist Party was spying on people. That was their way of keeping an eye on people. That was a belief that she had. Another one, this is personal to me and it's a bit embarrassing in a way, but when I was a teenager, about 12, 13, 14 or so, and I got my first stereo system and, you know, turned the volume up and listened louder and so on and turned it down again, I used to think that in the way the volume went louder and softer was because in the speakers there was little doors that would open up as to let more sound out, and when you turn the volume down, they would close up again. Well, perhaps we need to test it. Anyway, I went. One thing retrogression didn't mention, I went on to become an electrical engineer, dealing with voltages in the hundreds of thousands. So, a bit of a frightening thought. But anyway, so those are three examples of the way, you know, some people, including myself, have these views. And we all have views. We can't not have views. And in fact, in a very, very deep philosophical sense, I think shown by the great German philosopher Immanuel Kant, space, time, and causality are sort of the three basic categories of in our minds, of the way we structure reality, the way we structure experience. And we cannot have any experience of a world without those three basic categories. So causality or conditionality is very, very deeply embedded in our experience, in our minds. So the examples I gave, as I said, were kind of fairly lighthearted and a bit trivial. But a lot of our wrong views are in the area of ethical behaviour and ethical practice. And In Buddhism, of course, that which is unethical is that which causes ourselves and other people suffering or pain or unsatisfactoriness, at least. You know. So wrong views lead to suffering in ourselves and in other people. Yeah. So it's good to have a look at our views and see in what ways they're not serving our best interests or other people's as well. I've got a few quotes here from Bhante Sangharakshita from his book Wisdom Beyond Words. He said that Michaditti's wrong views are essentially a rationalization of a basic wrong attitude that is more emotional than as much as cognitive, or as much as conceptual. Yeah. So our wrong views are an expression in views and concepts and ideas of deeper-seated emotional goings-on, let's say. He also says, the view is a symptom from which you can infer the presence of a deep-seated disease, which is the wrong attitude. And a wrong view is pseudo-rational because it's held in accordance with an unacknowledged emotional bias. Yeah? So those are just some quotes from Sangharakshita. Yeah. So wrong views, we could say, are cognitive or conceptual aspects of negative emotions. And these have been dealt with in the previous two talks on the eighth and ninth precepts about craving or covetousness, neurotic desire and so on. It's the eighth precept. And the ninth one is about ill will or hatred and so on. Yeah. So you could say that negative emotions come with inbuilt wrong views. Yeah? So they're an integral part of it. It's a bit like when we do the metta bhavana practice, developing loving kindness for ourselves and for other people. A very important aspect of the metta bhavana is that we're developing a volitional attitude or emotional attitude of clarity and objectivity as much as the emotion or the volition itself. Yeah. So that's a very important aspect of metta. So likewise with negative emotions, the view is very much often an integral part of the emotion. So just for example, you may say at work or something, you may feel ill will or even stronger for someone you work with. It's very interesting perhaps to observe the view that you hold about the person. Maybe you think they're lazy or they're bossy or they arrive late at work all the time or they're sloppy in their work or they dress badly or you know, make many mistakes, or perhaps perhaps you've got a view that they come from a privileged background, or so you've got a chip on your shoulder, perhaps, or maybe they speak poorly, you know, their grammar's not very good or something. So we have all these views about people that we associate with, and we tend to pigeonhole them into particular kind of categories. We don't see them clearly as they are. And ultimately, if we take this tendency to an extreme, we can even sort of tend to dehumanize people. We tend to fix them with our views, and this our views then kind of work back on our emotions and tend to reinforce the negative emotion that we may feel towards the person. It changes the way we feel about them, even. So we did. Perhaps then we treat them with even less respect or less, importance and so on. We tend to avoid them, perhaps. So the view then works back and tends to justify or support, reinforce the negative emotion. So I've been talking here on a sort of a personal scale, on an individual level. But obviously, this also happens on a macro scale and in the world at large and in society at large, and you find that whole groups of people can become demonized or scapegoated or outcast, and these views can become built into belief systems, and they can actually be quite sophisticated and even philosophical and so on. And people write books about them and make whole careers out of basic wrong views, basically, which have a huge effect and impact on their society, on their country, and so on. They can even become kind of codified in law. And some horrific examples, of course, from history are, the Nazi period in Germany, what still goes on in India, very much with views about untouchability. So that practice, which is based very much on what is negative emotion involved and horrific violence very often, is supported by a whole sort of philosophical view behind it. So as I've been saying, the views reinforce and justify the ill treatment of other people. And as I've been suggesting, all manner of horrific actions can be perpetrated through this. So the view tends to absolutize the negative emotion and makes it even more difficult to change it. So the negative emotion becomes much more difficult to change when there's a view that's associated with it. This also happens, of course. I've been talking about ill will and hatred and negative emotion of that kind, but the whole area of craving, particularly, as an example of that would be falling in love with someone. We imagine all sorts of wonderful qualities that the person has, perhaps exaggerate them way beyond what they are. Perhaps even their faults become just sort of quaint little foibles that they have, and we kind of very much overlook them. And we don't necessarily always realise kind of the slippery slope we may be sliding down there, and we may find ourselves making major decisions about our lives, based on this infatuation that we wouldn't dream of making if we were in our right mind. I'm sure none of us here have been in that situation, but yeah. Anyway, so craving also can be very much in this category as well. So, it raises a question: well, how do we work with wrong views? So, I'm just going to offer a few suggestions here, and in particular, a little path that we can follow to work with wrong view. And I think that the first thing to do is simply acknowledge that we have a view. Often, we're just simply unaware of it. We just simply think that's the way things are, rather than thinking, "Oh, that's the way I think things are." So very often we don't even acknowledge or recognise that we have a view. So that's the first thing, is just to acknowledge that we have a view. The second thing is then, once we've spotted that we have a view about something or somebody, question ourselves whether it's a right view. You know, is it in accord with the way things are? Is it does it accord with how that person really is? So if you spend time with that person and really get to know them more deeply, you may find that actually the view you've had about them is actually quite different from what how they really are. I remember a couple of years ago, I was on the four-month ordination course. I was on the team at Bukit Loka for 4 months, and there was a couple of guys in my initial discussion group, and I knew that they both, I think, had a PhD in something or other. And so I had this view about them that, oh, they must have come from a really well-to-do family, you know, lots of money and you know, really supportive family and that. None of it. They were the reality of their background was completely different from that. Extremely difficult background that they came from. You know. It was a really good lesson, actually, in just the way I have carried around these sorts of views. So look for the wrong view. If it's there, and I think that the views that we have are a bit like the tip of the iceberg. Bhante Sangharakshita says that mistaken views can only be cut off by reaching their emotional basis. So we need to get down below the view and see what's driving it, really, where the power of it comes from. Acknowledging that we've got a view, becoming clear about that, is then to try and experience the negative emotion beneath it. Yeah. And maybe just simply admitting to yourself, I don't like so-and-so. I feel ill will towards person X. And I think that's totally fine. Maybe we English here, those of us who are English, we don't like to admit that we have emotions, but I think we very much do. So just kind of admit, and I think it's quite healthy actually, just to say I don't like that person, rather than trying to pretend that my view about them is all quite sort of rational and objective. Actually, it's not necessarily. It's coming from something, And then, so beneath the emotion is what we know, according to Buddhism, as a vedana, a feeling or sensation. So get down even below the emotion. And to feel the unpleasant vedana, the unpleasant sensation that arises or that is stimulated when you come in contact with the person. So get down to that level of. There's a whole kind of meditation course in here to do this sort of thing. I'm very much just touching the surface of it, really. But I think that's what we need to do, is get down to what we call primary experience, our initial sort of basic gut sort of feeling about what happens. And then when we're down at that level, then look for a kind, clear response to, So when we're in touch with that, then we've got much more control over what our response is to the person or situation. So I offer that as a way of working with wrong views. Conversely, you could say that a way of working with negative emotions and these unpleasant feelings that we may experience, or in the case of craving, the feelings are very pleasant, but that can lead us to becoming intoxicated. So it may be easier to deal with or to recognise to change a view than to change the emotion beneath it. So simply by working at the level of the view, that can have the effect of being able to change the emotions beneath it. It reminds me of the teaching of the 10 fetters, where it said, I think, that the first 3 fetters are known as the intellectual fetters. Not that they're just on the level of intellect or concept by any means. They're much, much deeper than that. But at least we can begin to work with them at that level. The view of a fixed self view, that we have a view of ourselves that quite deeply that we're fixed and unchanging, or that there's a part of us that doesn't change. The second one is about doubt. And the third is attachment to rites and rituals as ends in themselves. either way, it's very important to get ultimately down to this level of primary experience, Vedana, feeling, sensation. I've been talking here very much about wrong views about other people, that we have about other people. But of course, we also have many wrong views about ourselves, and these can be quite difficult to spot. And I think this is where having good friends who can get to know you well and reflect back to you, you know, in a kindly, gentle sort of way, things you may not see about yourself, is very, very important. So there's a whole area there about views about oneself. There's also, we can pick up wrong views about the Dharma, the teaching of the Buddha itself. And I'm reminded of the story in the Pali Canon where the Buddha's talking about, you know, grabbing the Dharma by the wrong end, or misunderstanding the Dharma, is like grabbing a poisonous snake by the tail. You know, if you do that, you'll find it very quickly flips around and wraps itself around your arm and bites you. Yeah. So even the Dharma, if it's misunderstood, can lead to suffering. I remember after being ordained maybe 10 years or 12 years or something, I realised I had a subtle wrong view about the non-self doctrine, the Anatman doctrine, in that this wasn't very conscious, but when I began to reflect about it, I realised my understanding of it, partly at least, was that because there's no part of me that ultimately doesn't change or can't change, therefore I can change into anything, I can be anything or do anything, without taking into account, you know, my temperament, my psychological type, my, you know, inclinations and so on, and interests in that. Yeah. So it was kind of a subtle wrong view there. Hmm. Just an example of the way we can, you know, take a Dharma teaching and misapply it or misunderstand it. Yeah. just the last point about wrong views that I want to make is that, so I've been talking very much here in conceptual terms, but the Yogacara tradition, the one of the great Mahayana traditions, presents this sort of process in terms of wonderful images or metaphors, and one that I particularly like is you know, you're walking along and you see the shape on the ground and you think it's a snake, and suddenly you get a fright and recoil in horror or fear of it. But when you look more closely at it, you see that it's a rope. Yeah? So you misunderstood the perception that you had of it, and then ultimately you see it going beyond seeing it as a rope and seeing it as just this kind of bunch of fibres kind of tied together. Yeah? So maybe images can help us more to understand these teachings. So very often, I think in life, we're just seeing snakes everywhere, you know, instead of seeing these beautiful ropes. I don't think that's much better, but but anyway, I hope you get my drift there. Right. So I better move on to wisdom. Actually, the first thing I want to say about wisdom is the word wisdom is a sort of, I think you call it an abstract noun. And actually, there's no such thing as wisdom. There are only people who are wise. There are only wise minds. So I quite like using the term, the wise mind, rather than developing wisdom, as though it's a thing that you're going to get from outside and sort of add on to yourself, rather than something that you cultivate within yourself and become wise. And I'll just remind you what I said earlier about a wise mind is a compassionate mind. So just bear that in mind as I'm speaking. And of course, the wisest person of all that we are aware of, or that we tend to think of as most wise, was the Buddha himself, Shakyamuni. His wisdom consisted in a very, very deep level, beyond our any ability we have to understand it, is that he saw things as they really are. Yeah. And with that, he felt unbounded, unlimited compassion for all living beings. It was a transcendental way of seeing and feeling. That is, it transcends completely any experience that we have. Now, so the Buddha had this experience of awakening, of enlightenment, which is, you know, seeing things in the very, very depths of their nature and feeling unbounded compassion. And he found it extremely difficult, if not impossible, to communicate that experience, because it's an experience beyond language, beyond images, beyond concepts, beyond any sort of category that we have. He was very reluctant or reticent to communicate it. And this is portrayed in the story of Brahmasahampati having to encourage the Buddha to communicate his experience. Bhante, in his book of memoirs, Moving Against the Stream, says that the Buddha's enlightenment found conceptual expression for purpose of communication in the principle of conditionality. And I like to, or tend to think of the Buddha as torn between, or struggling with, these two great forces. One is the force of deep, deep compassion in himself to alleviate suffering for all living beings, on the one hand. But on the other hand, this force that he knew that if he communicated his experience inadequately, that it would be misunderstood, misconstrued, and misapplied, and therefore the import of experience could easily be lost. Yeah. So I see him kind of torn between these two great sort of pulls in himself. This principle of conditionality in Sanskrit is known as praticca samutpada. I think probably most of us heard of that. And I tend to think of it as it being that the least that the Buddha could say about his experience without saying nothing at all. Yeah? If he'd said any less, he would have just had to be completely silent. Yeah? But it was the most he could say without leaving himself wide open for misunderstanding or being misconstrued. So it's kind of the middle way between those two extremes. I think you could also say that this teaching of Praticca Samuppada is the only doctrine in Buddhism. Everything else is method. Everything else is an application of this fundamental teaching of conditionality. So every other teaching we find in Buddhism is an application of Praticca Samuppada to a particular circumstance or situation. It's a means. It's offering a means to awakening, to enlightenment. A means to the alleviation of suffering. So, for example, the Four Noble Truths. The Buddha observed and experienced in himself before enlightenment that there is suffering in the world, and it's a universal experience. We all at least feel unsatisfactoriness in our lives to some extent, or even to a great extent. So he perhaps asked the question, well, what are the conditions that give rise to the experience of suffering or unsatisfactoriness? And then he observed in his own experience, well, there is freedom from suffering. I am now free from suffering through becoming awakened. Okay, so what were the conditions that led to this experience of freedom from suffering? And that is the basis of the Four Noble Truths. They're an application or a method of Praticca Samuppada. And I even wonder whether Praticca Samuppada itself could be said to be a method rather than a doctrinal statement. That the Buddha is saying to us, well, I can't say in any concepts or words or images what the enlightenment experience is like, but if you want to experience it yourself, well, you need to follow find out the conditions that will lead you there. Yeah. So he's saying, I'm offering you this teaching that you need to find the adequate conditions to awaken. And I imagine, for example, a situation, I'll just give a teaching which we may know, that the Buddha is so we say coaching or helping a monk, one of his disciples, you know, getting faithful as a monk. And this monk is a bit miserable. He's a bit unhappy. He's he's just not getting on very well with his practice. He wants to return to lay life. You know, he become a householder again. He perhaps his body's a bit achy and that. So the Buddha says to him, okay, well, I tell you what, go away for a week and really pay attention to this experience of dukkha that you're experiencing. Dukkha means unsatisfactoriness or suffering. You know? Really go into it, experience it as deeply as you can, observe how it arises, observe in your experience where it comes from, observe how your mind is perpetuating it, making it more suffering and so on. Okay, so he goes away, comes back a week later, and he says, oh, you know what's happened? I'm feeling a bit more expansive, a bit more open, a bit more, I've got a bit more confidence in myself, a bit more confidence that I can be different, that I can change a bit, even that I can be a bit more like you. And the Buddha says, that's interesting. Sounds like a bit like what we'd call shraddha, or confidence, or faith, or trust. So the Buddha says, okay, so go away for another week, 2 weeks, and really pay attention to this experience of shraddha, of confidence in yourself. Really go into it, expand it, develop it, and of course stay in touch with the dukkha. It's not going to go away, so that's got to be, you know, you need to pay attention to that as well. It goes away for a week, it comes back a week later, and he says, hey, you know, this is great. I'm experiencing... Oh, I could say happiness, even contentment in my life at the moment. And through paying more attention to shraddha, I began to change the way I think, the way I relate to people, the way I go about, you know, in my interactions with people and so on. And I'm just feeling a bit more happy, contented, and satisfied in a healthy sort of way. He said, I don't know if it's my imagination, but, you know, the lay people seem to be putting nicer food in my bowl and that. So the Buddha says, okay, just really go away for another week and really pay attention to this happiness. Don't let it go, but stay in touch also with the shraddha and the dukkha beneath it. So he does that very, very faithfully and earnestly. Comes back and says, wow, you know, what's happened? I'm experiencing these floods of pleasure just, you know, washing through my body, flooding through my body. It's intensely pleasurable. Physical sensations I've never experienced before. All, you know, completely innocent and so on. But, everybody says, well, sounds like preeti. The experience of what we call preeti. And anyway, so it goes on like this. I think you can see where it's going, those who are familiar with this teaching. Possibly, you know, the Buddha, he didn't come up with a kind of a prepackaged whole set of teachings to give to his disciples. They came out of his experience. They came out of his working with people. And it's just some, you know, an imaginary example I thought of how it might have unfolded. So he thought, well, perhaps this is a teaching that would be useful to offer to someone else, to other people. So then these teachings became, codified in that way. Right. So I think applying this in our own lives, the law of conditionality, particularly in the area of karma. I think that's the area we particularly need to focus on. Not just that, but all areas generally, but just observing the way our minds, particularly our volitional actions of mind, condition our speech and our actions, and how those how our speech and actions condition events in the world around us, and how those events in the world around us then very often come back to us in some way. Yeah. So that's the area of conditionality I think that we particularly need to pay attention to, the whole area of karma. So, and it's really important to understand that as clearly as possible. Yeah. But I just want to mention, to finish this section off, that I think Pratitya Samuppada, the conditioned co-production or dependent arising, as you may choose to call it, is the middle way between two extremes that we all tend to fall into one way or the other. So, and there's a famous little passage where Ananda says to the Buddha, says, you know, this teaching on Pratitya Samuppada that you've given us, it's great, it's wonderful, but, you know, it's pretty obvious, isn't it? I can see it's pretty clear. And the Buddha says, say not so, Ananda, say not so. It's really, really profound, it's really, really deep, and it's because people don't understand it that their lives, our lives, get in such a mess at times, and that the world is in such a tangle. Yeah. So it's because we don't understand it. So I think, these two extremes, I think, that we tend to fall into, one extreme is we tend to think that events happen kind of randomly in our lives, you know, that there doesn't seem to be much rhyme or reason why things happen to me. Yeah. We can't see much sort of pattern or clear sequence of conditions. Perhaps it's sort of the buying the lottery ticket of just hoping for the best sort of attitude to life. Yeah. So that's one extreme, that we think, oh, it doesn't matter what I do, you know, I can't see any clear connection between what I do and what happens to me or what happens to other people and so on. That's one extreme. And the other is that what happens to in my life, to me and to other people, is destiny or fate or the will of God or something like that. This is the other extreme we may tend towards. We read the tarot or the horoscopes or the I Ching or something like this, and many other things that we just think that what happens to us is fate. It's our destiny. That there's nothing we can do about it. Yeah. And so, as I say, in all sorts of subtle ways, I think we probably tend to fall in or veer towards one extreme or the other of these two, and maybe swing between them even. And the important thing about these kind of views is that they are disempowering. Yeah. They don't encourage us to take responsibility for our lives, to make changes in our lives. Yeah? If you think things just happen randomly or by fate, we're not going to be inclined to try and change things. So one of the wonderful things about Pratitya Samuppada, I think, is that it is supremely empowering. It offers a way to take control of our lives. Of course, there are many things beyond our control. I'm not saying that, you know, we control. There's so much we cannot control, obviously. But in things which are of real deep importance, we do have much more control than we may think. Okay. So that's just what I want to say about Pratitya Samuppada, the first aspect of, the wisdom I want to touch on. And, so the second... So yes, so I've said that Pratitya Samuppada, the principle of conditionality, is the fundamental Buddhist teaching of, and we could say it's of explicit meaning. Yeah, it means exactly what it says or what it said. Yeah, but the Mahayana Buddhism came along and elaborated on, expanded on this idea of the principle of conditionality, and into, I think, a very beautiful and elegant idea, concept, teaching or principle known as shunyata. You could say that shunyata is the fundamental principle or teaching of implicit meaning. Yeah? By which I mean that if you just say what shunyata means in a very basic sense, it's not explicit. And I think for this reason, it's often misunderstood and has quite sort of bad press, even amongst Buddhists, or amongst many Buddhists. Just a few weeks ago, I was on retreat, an order retreat, actually, and one of the order members in the discussion group was was saying that his view of Dronita is quite sort of, is a very negative view of it, that he sees it as like this great abyss that we're all going to fall into. It's like a big black hole, a big emptiness, a big nothingness, or a huge void, and not a very inspiring view at all. But I just wonder if that is not what Shunyata means. The word, of course, Shunyata literally means emptiness, and Shunya is the adjective that means empty. So that's literally what it means. There's no getting around that. But of course, in English, you know, the word empty is quite a harmless, benign little word. We use it all the time, quite regularly. For example, I've got this cup here, and if I say to you, this cup is empty, you know, we all know that I'm not saying this cup does not exist. Yeah, I'm saying it's empty of tea, or it's empty of coffee, or it's empty of water, or something, or some other contents. Yeah, so when we use the word empty in ordinary language, we just simply mean it's empty of something. We don't say that always, of course, but we know that that's what it means. And I think this is the same with the word shunyata, that when we say something is shunya, as it says in the Heart Sutra, form is empty, emptiness is form. Yeah? The same is true of feelings, perceptions, volitions, consciousness itself. Yeah? These are all empty. And so the heart and emptiness is form. Is feelings, is perception, is volitions, is consciousness. And that is the totality of our experience. Yeah? So I think the Heart Sutra there is not saying that these things don't exist in an absolute sense. Yeah? I think what it's saying is these things are empty of something. Yeah? So what are they empty of? So I want to suggest that they are empty of, for example, permanence. Yeah? My experience is empty of permanence. It's just changing all the time. Everything I can experience, everything I can imagine, is constantly changing. So it's empty of permanence. It's empty of being able to give me complete satisfaction. Yeah? So it's empty of the quality of complete satisfaction. It's empty of substantiality. It's empty of being ultimately real. It doesn't mean it's completely unreal, but it's not completely real. It's empty of independent existence. So it is all these things, all my experience arises independent on conditions. It's empty of intrinsic or inherent existence. That everything in my experience is related to everything else, to other things. Yeah? So everything is in relationship to everything else. And then you could say it's empty of it's all my experience, every aspect of my experience is ineffable. It's indescribable. It's indefinable. It's mysterious. It's completely mysterious. It's inconceivable. Yeah. So this is another aspect of shunyata, that things are just completely, ultimately speaking, mysterious, wondrous, and marvellous, full of potential. There's a quote I quite like, which I already remember. I can't remember where I heard it first, but things are not only more mysterious than we imagine, they are more mysterious than we can imagine. Yeah? So things are just actually, ultimately speaking, just completely mysterious and wonderful. And yet we kind of reduce them to this this way of just trying to limit them and try and describe or understand them completely. So we could render shunyata as fullness or as plenitude. Yeah? Everything in my experience is full of mystery, full of wonder, full of potential, full of hope. So the wise mind sees things very much more in terms of openness and possibility and potential. and in a less conditioned and less in a more creative way. So these are all aspects of shunyata. So for me, the concept of shunyata is very, very beautiful and elegant and very uplifting, actually. So anyway, those are a few ideas I've had about transforming ignorance into wisdom. And I just remind you that whenever we talk about wisdom, we're also talking about compassion. And the other thing, which I don't have any... I mean, there's a whole, at least our talk about compassion, and another talk one could give is the whole idea of wisdom as beauty and aesthetic appreciation. So opening oneself up to beauty and becoming a more beautiful mind. So that's a whole kind of other way of looking at wisdom. So you probably noticed I've been focusing very much on wisdom in terms of kind of concepts. If you could say the cognitive way of looking at wisdom or approach to it. But there's other ways. There's the affective, the compassionate way. There's also the aesthetic, the beautiful way of seeing wisdom. Yeah. So I just offer you those, just tantalizing it at the end. And in a way, I invite someone to go and write talks about those and come back and present wisdom in those terms as well. Yeah. So thank you all very much.